Welcome to this week's edition of Exporting Malta, where I, Monique Chambers, am joined by businesses that have sold their product and services overseas. Welcome to this week's edition of Exporting Malta with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Joe Scembry. Now, you are wearing two hats for this interview. So firstly, Trade Malta is your day job, so to speak, but you also lecture here at the University of Malta on internationalisation.
Yes, correct. great to be here. I've done a PhD at the University of Glasgow in international business, looking at knowledge-intensive firms based in Malta. And as you said, my day job is at Trade Malta. Trade Malta is a partnership between the Chamber of Commerce and government, essentially mandated to assist companies based in Malta to internationalize, to find, you know, success in international markets. And that's what we do at Trade Malta. We do this in various ways, and we can discuss this later on. But of course, I do, you know, research in the area, and I teach a class in here, which is also a class in international business.
So what led you to doing a PhD sort of later in life, so to speak?
True. partly a curiosity I always had.
Okay.
Because of my kind of practical or industry experience at Trade Malta and prior to that at Malta Enterprise, I've met companies and I was always curious how, you know, they made the success, an international success, being based in Malta. We have certain inherent disadvantages in Malta, and somehow there are these companies that continue to kind of fascinate me. And this curiosity drove me to, you know, read about these kind of companies, not just knowledge intensive companies, but companies in general, and what makes them, you know, successful. And this is actually, you know, this drove me to do the research first. And I found some interesting, you know, findings, but mostly it was this curiosity about how these companies, what kind of habits they had that made them successful. And, you know, at the end of the process, I've just finished my doctorate now a few months ago. I kind of confirmed that really and truly, Malta in certain areas, in certain sectors, can be highly successful, can have very successful companies out of Malta. And it convinced me even more that even in our kind of economic vision in general, you know, we should not build an economy necessarily built on building more apartments and actually, you know, make Malta a sustainable economy.
Okay. And you talked about sort of knowledge-based companies. What's the difference? How do you classify
knowledge-based? In fact, yes. I've studied seven companies based in Malta. About three of the seven companies are software companies,
right.
So they produce software, either, you know, ad hoc software for other companies, or as they have a software product. There's a recruitment company amongst them, there's a language education company, and there's a fund management company. Knowledge intensive companies are those companies that essentially use knowledge predominantly in the product or service that they sell, and they sell it internationally.
Okay. And so what was the overlying factor? You said you found some interesting things. What is it about Maltese companies that makes them, you know, good, or these certain companies that actually makes them successful overseas?
There are some things that are obviously shared even with other best practices abroad, not necessarily Maltese, but I guess the fact that they are based in Malta makes them more, you know, eager to go out there, you know, network more. For example, networking is one interesting finding. Again, this has been a finding in international business for many, many years. But I found that in Malta, this is even more relevant in the sense that we have small companies many times that do not even afford to do, you know, formal market research. But compensating for that, they do a lot of traveling. And therefore, they learn a lot. And therefore, networking, for example, is one of them.
Right.
Apart from that, of course, you have the actual innovation that they have, which in reality, in knowledge-intensive industries, is immaterial of where you're based. And therefore, you have companies in Malta with enough innovation to be able to mitigate the disadvantage of distance and of the geographical, you know, peripherality, kind of.
But you do find that, you know, Malta, you always think of as somewhere that's very multilingual. We are very competitive, very entrepreneurial, it seems anyway, and great connections. So it's kind of,
true.
Is it just a sort of, I don't know, a fear of the Maltese themselves not wanting to expand? do you think? Is there some sort of stigma there that, oh, I'm from this tiny rock, I'm not going to make it?
I guess there might be. I've spent a lot of time with these seven entrepreneurs and with their kind of management teams, and there are some traits that are kind of common.
Mm-hmm.
All of them either have, you know, either studied abroad or have been traveling before, but all of them have this kind of determination,
okay,
you know, to essentially try to mitigate the normal kind of barriers that you would have in Malta and go out there. And what you find today, of course, is that it's much easier to do because of technology, because travel is easier, etc.
That's it, because market research must have been quite difficult 20 years ago. Now with the internet, you sort of...
Everything is so much easier.
I can't imagine being born before the internet, actually. I just
before Google.
Yeah, quite tough life. So you did your PhD. How long did that sort of take?
It took 5 years, but on a part-time basis, uh-huh, of course. I was, you know, still doing other things and uh-huh, working as well, but it took
and
5 years.
You've branched into internationalization full on. That's what you lecture on now here.
That's what I do in here. I do a class in international business and a class in public policy.
Okay.
But at the moment I'm doing this class in international business, which is, as I was saying, part of a master's degree in strategy and management.
Uh-huh.
So you typically have a class which is a mix of either students who would have progressed from their undergrad, uh-huh, typically in Malta, and others who are practitioners in industry. And it's usually, you know, a class based on discussions and trying to really communicate and discuss, you know, salient points, both in my research and in what's happening even out there in, you know, the basic, you know, kind of lessons learned in international business.
So are all these people that are on the course, their businesses, are they generally knowledge-based as well, or are they product as well?
No, some of them would be students, basically, and therefore they wouldn't be engaged with a company.
Okay, at all.
But the ones who are engaged with companies come from various backgrounds. The basic principles of internationalization and international business apply to any company.
Okay, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. The basic kind of, you know, principles of networking, of being organized in a certain way, you know, apply to all companies. My study just focused on knowledge-based industries because I thought that this was something happening in Malta and there was something a bit particular about
it. So what's one of the things that you find as a lecturer that your students are surprised when it comes to internationalization, that people just take for granted? Is it that we speak English and they speak English and therefore, you know,
yes, even
you
that
understand each other?
Uh-huh. Even that, you know, the language, but also things which have been, you know, established in the literature, and we'll speak a bit about the, mm-hmm, the theory about the literature, and that might kind of sound a bit obvious, like networking, again. Like, for example, the need to, you know, share knowledge amongst management, because the company kind of learns through, you know, the experience of various people, and therefore sharing that information grows the knowledge in the company. These things, rather than surprise, I would say kind of reaffirm, you know, what people might think is either obvious or else, you know, completely new because they're coming from different backgrounds.
Uh-huh.
And in reality, research continues to show that there are certain basics that continue to be very relevant, you know, irrespective of the technologies that we use nowadays. You know, the basics continue to be the basics.
So all those sort of stereotypes that we have of, you know, the Spanish taking long lunches and the Italians sort of worrying about what they're wearing to work and the Americans never inviting you home, that's all true?
Some of it is true, and this is now my hat at Trade Malta, uh-huh, because obviously we interact with a lot of companies and we, you know, take companies to trade missions and help companies to travel to do international business, and a lot of it is true. But, you know, it's stereotypical, but it's useful.
Mm. Useful to know, so there's no major faux pas and
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly.
What are the main areas that you teach in internationalization then? So there's a cultural aspect, is there?
There is surely a cultural aspect. There's a lot we discuss, which is strategy,
mm-hmm,
essentially, and what to do and what not to do, and the importance of research and understanding the market where you're going. But more than that, the understanding the company and the capabilities of the company.
Your own company.
Your own company.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Because many times, you know how it is in marketing in general, it's a match between what the product and the service, mm-hmm, is and what the market requires. In international business, that becomes a little bit more complex because the client is typically not in here, but is a bit far away. But the principles of understanding the customer, of developing products or projects with, you know, clients to be able to kind of understand your company and its capabilities even more, become even more, you know, important. So these are the kind of discussions we typically have.
But what about, like, being Malta, being the small place that it is, and obviously there's some, you know, recent history, how are Maltese companies accepted overseas? Are they, you know, welcomed, or is like, oh, you're too small, don't, you know, or is it we have this European background and so therefore we're more trusted, more?
I think we still struggle to a degree. We, and again, this is from the Trade Malta perspective and from our kind of practitioner, you know, practice, we try to assist companies even kind of build awareness.
Okay.
And we've invested in a portal at Trade Malta, which is quite good in the sense that it tries to explain why Malta has certain capabilities, and we find that clients in Malta find it useful because, as you're saying, when they go to meet an international prospect, the prospect would typically ask, you know, is a company from Malta capable of doing something like this? Mm. So there is need for assistance in that sense, in building, you know, an awareness, a brand, which we still kind of suffer from. Also because our economy is very diverse, you know, the diversification has its pluses, because it makes the economy more resilient. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you don't have a lot of strength in one sector. Therefore, it's very hard to build a brand in general, you know, in that sector.
Yeah.
So the companies would require that awareness, because at the end of the day, you know, we're small and we're known out there, you know, for tourism and financial services, and not for other things. And therefore, the companies need assistance, including by public agencies like Trade Malta, to kind of mitigate that, you know, lack of brand out there.
But it's also very sensible of the Maltese and, you know, agencies like Trade Malta to diversify, because just relying on one or two major strengths.
Absolutely. This has been, I think, one of our, you know, great strengths in general in Malta for the last 30 or so years. You know, when the British started, you know, reducing their presence in Malta, I guess we learned the lesson, you know, that we were dependent on one sector, in those days, the British services, and therefore diversification was going to be key. And it remained like that. I mean, we need to diversify even more, and at the same time, we need to grow and make each sector a bit more solid, especially in internationalization, where companies are going out there.
So what are the sectors that have strength and have a good chance of succeeding overseas? And I'm sure there are particular countries that we fare better with. But what are the industries that do well leaving Malta?
I think there are, and again, from mostly from the practice at Trade Malta, there's a lot happening in the ICT space, in software, and in other areas in the information communication technology in general. Again, that's because it's knowledge intensive. Also, that's because our cost arbitrage is typically, you know, much better, and we're kind of competitive cost-wise as well. At the same time, we provide a good service in software in the general IT space. But there are many other areas, including certain areas in manufacturing, including areas in services, engineering, etc. Because you have a situation, and we find this again both from research and from my practice at Trade Malta, that whereas you have certain sectors that we try to focus on and certain countries and markets that we try to target, at the same time you have individual companies that are high potential companies, and we try to identify them irrespective of the sector they're in. Sometimes you have a high potential company not in a sector which we would typically associate with potential success, but yet with a little help either from Trade Malta or otherwise, you know, they will succeed and do something.
Is there someone that you can talk about on that sort of, you know, a little bit more unusual, people we may not have?
Well, I'm trying to think of unusuals. You've had a number of very interesting cases on this show, a number of companies that are coming in. You had a film company,
yes,
for example.
Fantastically interesting.
That was a very interesting interview. In a sector which, again, we're traditionally known in Malta as a film location, not as a country where you have companies that company does. And therefore, that's an interesting case.
Very,
you know, it's not the sector per se, but it's an individual company doing well, irrespective of the reputation of the sector, if you know what I mean.
Okay. And so people, like, I can remember that story, they kind of obviously had actually worked with Trade Malta as well, but their business was so random in a sense that you're as good as your last job, because not all films are made in the same place. And they ended up in Spain and then into California, and then, you know, they sort of bounced all over the world based on their last reputation. But how can you teach internationalization? How can you get people ready to, you know, they've realized that they need to springboard off Malta? Obviously the size of the country is, you know, what it is. Our market size is what it is. How do you teach them to get big and take that big scary step?
Part of it is And what we try to do even here at university is teach kind of the kind of basic principles.
Okay.
The basic principles then are applied to the different business models. You know, you're talking about a film, you know, After Effects company. It could be a company doing something completely different. The basic principles of, you know, being structured, mm-hmm. of doing proper networking, of doing an investment in people, in mm-hmm. quality, in innovation. These are the kind of principles that are run through kind of all companies, all kind of activities that could be internationalized. Having these kind of habits, if you like, in place, in a structured and proper way, you know, prepares the company much more.
Okay.
Then beyond that, it's a matter of going out there and trying to, you know, find opportunities. Many, many, many companies, and my research hopefully confirms this as well, and I thought it was quite interesting, is that companies build their own kind of journeys internationally mm-hmm. around the opportunities they actually meet, not necessarily the opportunities they were going for originally.
Okay.
You know, so there is a degree of, you know, surprise, and they build the company around key opportunities.
And that's very Maltese, that kind of, you know, you spot an opportunity, you go for it, whether it's, you know, the tourism after the British, whether it's the, you know, being able to make anything you turn your hand to, you know.
Exactly.
So that's really, but networking, that to me is the scariest word ever. Just the thought of it terrifies me. So how would you get someone like me, who's a little bit shy, believe it or not, to network? What are the things, the two or three things that one needs to just man up and do?
To be honest, I'm not sure if there's any theory that explains how to do it. What we have is that it's really essential. Mm-hmm. I guess then from practice, what's important is, you know, be yourself, in the sense that, you know, I've seen many people, and we organize a lot of activities at Trade Malta for people to network. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of kind of superficial networking. You know, people just dishing out business cards, and it obviously doesn't work. Whereas engaging in conversation when you have something to say, that's networking in the most kind of natural and, you know, authentic way.
And the people just connect to you, and you connect to them, and then remember you better than just...
Exactly. And many times companies go out there in international trade fairs where we assist them in conferences, etc. And they network today and reap something out of it, you know, in a couple of years' time, not necessarily immediately.
So it's like a relationship building rather than just a card swapping.
I think that distinction is really important. It's relationship building and relationship sustaining. And that's also something we try to do both at Trade Malta and in what we teach here at university.
Because there are some people who just get it so wrong that you just feel like you're being stalked for the next two or three days. It's like, go away!
And that's becoming so common. that's obviously, you know, we try to tell people and students in here, you know, to steer away from that behavior, of course.
And it's, you know, the LinkedIn, and then they tag you on Facebook, and then you're like, give me a break. I haven't even got in my car, and you're already
you're
friending
being watched
me.
All the time.
Yeah, so that there are people that do it badly. People like me don't do it at all. And then there's people who do it well that end up with these long term relationships that then they can spin the opportunity.
Also, because many companies go out there in international trade fairs, mm-hmm. conferences, etc., and essentially learn a lot about that market. So mm-hmm. it's not only about networking to attain an opportunity or to attain a client, but also to learn about what's happening in an industry. In every industry in the world, there are a couple of international trade fairs in Europe mm-hmm. That everyone is present for. You know, and therefore we encourage companies, I'm talking here on the Trade Malta and Center, to provide, to attend these, you know, because they're very important for market research and for knowledge, apart from networking.
And that's seeing also what your competitors are doing, not just what your customers actually want to. And seeing how they do it and how they deliver it and everything from your,
And getting either reassurance or a shock of mm-hmm. where you stand and where your product and service stands out there. You know, in an open market, and I think that's very, very insightful and useful for companies.
And even pricing, everything. It's really a big eye opener.
Absolutely.
And you talked earlier about structure as well, being more structured. You'd imagine most of the companies who've filled the local market and they want to go overseas that they have particular things in place, but everything changes. The whole financial structure, everything.
Of course.
Changes, so that's a part of what they're taught as well here.
Yes, we even kind of let me go to the research first. One of the interesting findings is that a lot of successful companies are structured, even if they're informal. You know, so they have CRM systems or, you know, customer relationship management systems, which can be basic but at least it capture all the relationships they have with every supplier and with every client,
okay.
In a way that the company essentially accumulates knowledge,
okay,
over time. Simple habits. Another company, for example, has a routine where every 6 months, I believe, they get together in a strategy meeting. And the people who are typically traveling to international trade fairs are asked to do presentations.
Okay.
What that does essentially is get them to, you know, share that knowledge with all the others, and also get them to kind of write it down and document it. And therefore, the company is gaining this knowledge. So this is being structured in a very simple way, to be able to kind of accumulate knowledge and to be able to share information, because that's really, really important. Then obviously there is a point, and it is also something that came out of the research, that the company needs to kind of structure up, in the sense that needs to go to a, you know, top gear,
uh-huh,
in terms of structure, where you're no longer a small company and therefore there's a change. And that's something which was quite interesting, because I managed to trace these maybe 1 point or 2 points in all these seven,
okay,
you know, company histories, essentially. It was quite interesting.
Because it's funny, because often you find the CEO, you know, the founder, whatever, being seriously involved and them having all these fantastic skills, but then them not being the person doing the work on the ground. So they might be a great networker, but suddenly they're sending someone out there who's...
Exactly, and there's a bottleneck, of course.
Yes, so then that might change the expectation,
yes,
or the delivery, actually.
Yeah. One of the main challenges, in fact, many companies face is this transition from the founder,
mm-hmm,
being the main business development person to a structure that introduces someone who is external. And in all companies, you have a situation where the process isn't smooth, typically, you know, and they change a couple of people until they find, you know, someone who's like the internationalization manager,
mm-hmm,
who's here to stay.
And it could be the other way, that the founders are not the best person to do it.
They'd be technical people rather than, you know, people who are doing the marketing bit or the internationalization.
And have you found the cultural aspects in terms of even the time it takes to do things? Is that something, because the Maltese are pretty organized.
Mm-hmm.
I know we sort of we're always late, but we're pretty organized in terms of what we need to do is generally done on time, unless you're a builder.
Exactly. They're not exceptions.
But in sort of day-to-day office work, it's quite organized. How is that overseas? Are we always waiting for something after 30 days and it doesn't happen? How is our
tempo? Mostly, from our work at Trade Malta, we find, for example, we assist a lot of companies based in Malta do business, for example, in the Middle East, where the response to emails and the timely response to any, you know, inquiry is on a different tempo completely than what you would expect in Europe.
Right.
And where you have a culture that essentially is built on trust, and trust that is built slowly, you know, over many, many encounters, over teas and coffees before, you know, you start discussing what it is that you were there to discuss. And many companies come to us, you know, with this kind of frustration. We find, and because we've done a lot of trade missions, for example, to the Middle East in the last few years, that this is normal for them. It's a matter of kind of respecting, you know, cultures, as long as you're aware of it and you know how to go around it and have the patience in this case, you know, companies do well. But it varies very much. And we have
also, finance must be a difficult thing, because if normally your sales cycle would be, you know, 90 days, and all of a sudden it's, you know, 9 months, because you have this different culture to deal with. Keeping that company afloat and motivated to continue until...
Yes, absolutely.
And then once you've got the first deal, you've probably got the next deal. But
exactly. No, but finance, the financial outlay of a company seriously thinking of internationalization is substantial.
Mm.
Because, as you said, the sales cycles are typically very long. If you're doing business in a different country, especially in countries that are kind of far away, even travel is expensive, apart from the lead time because of cultural issues, as we're mentioning. So there's a lot of, you know, kind of exposure in financial terms, and thinking of financing that is a major issue that we discuss both in our courses at university and at Trade Malta.
And even things like, I'm just thinking, you know, if you do business with New Zealand, for example, or Australia, you have to have staff available when they're at work, not just,
yes,
you know,
the management
time.
Of
so it makes
of
a whole
time
different
zones.
Whole different thing.
You had one company, I think, in the series doing a lot of e-commerce business in the US.
Yes.
And that's interesting, because though they were doing a lot of e-commerce business where they did not need to be present, really, now they're investing a lot in after sales structures where they needed to employ people, you know, close to the market.
Yes.
It's quite fascinating because this is e-commerce, you know, the height of, you know, technology, but yet people need to see other people. And they are now employing people in the US, for example, to do after sales and to build relationships, because at the end of the day, it's like that.
That's what, because you want to, in that particular case, that you need to be definitely trusting because of what they're doing. They're holding your data, so
trust,
you definitely
really
need
key.
To be trusting. And knowing that there is a sort of face at the end of the line, you don't just want a little bot answering all your questions.
Absolutely.
You want it to be someone you can call up when it doesn't quite work or whatever.
Exactly. Yes, it does.
So, but no, that's another sort of cost factor people have to go to. Is there anything else you can pass along to our listeners, things that they should really consider when they're about to take the leap of internationalization?
Great. I think we're very, very happy to be, you know, assisting some very interesting companies based in Malta at Trade Malta, and also from the research I've done over the last, you know, couple of years. Some points we haven't mentioned, for example, are the importance of the first project. Many times what I observed is that the first project, the first international project, tends to shape, you know, the service or the product of the company based in Malta, and tends to, in a way, determine the success of the other products that come of the other projects, that come after.
Okay.
So one opportunity kind of leads to the other. And typically a lot of these seven companies I was observing had a client in Malta that was a typically a sophisticated client, in the sense that they were demanding clients. And because of that, you know, experience, many times, sometimes unpleasant, they pushed them to develop a product or a service that could stand, you know, the pressure of internationalization. I thought that was also something which came out of the research, which I find quite interesting. And I try to insert it, if you like, in the lectures.
So next time you have a client who's a bit of a pain, they're actually helping you strengthen
your product offering. You should thank them.
Is there anything else? Any last tidbits we can pass on? Is there, you know, identifying opportunities? Is there a just go for it kind of?
There is a lot of just go for it.
Ah.
I just found that, you know, just go for it in a structured way usually helps everyone, and is really some, you know, it kind of delivers results. And, you know, that's what we're here to do at Trade Malta, and that's what the research seems to be saying. So that's what we try to discuss even with students who will eventually take on positions in international business and companies in Malta.
Fantastic. It's been really interesting talking to you, Joe Skembri of Trade Malta and lecturer here at the University of Malta.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of Exporting Malta, produced by me, Monique Chambers, with technical assistance from Carmelo Grek and Redent Abdillah. This show is aired every Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. and repeated on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. here on Campus FM.